Committee to order. Welcome, members, after a weekend, and welcome to those of you in the audience. We're going to change the order a bit in our itinerary. We're going to begin with House Bill 2817, and then we'll move to the top of the list and follow it down in order from there. So with that in mind, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2817. Jim, do you want to do a staff summary for us?
Yes, sir. House Bill 2817 creates the Oregon Post-Secondary Education Council Task Force for the purpose of increasing coordination among post-secondary institutions in the state, specifies duties of the task force, and appropriates $500,000 for the task force support, sunset task force in 2006. There are amendments.
Okay. I believe, is Senator Brown and Senator Morse available? You are indeed. Come up, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 21, Southeast, a little in Portland, a little bit of Northeast Portland, and all of Milwaukee. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you today to speak about the future of our state's higher education system. I'm in support of House Bill 2817 and think it's a step in the right direction. The creation of a task force to study and design a higher education coordinating council will ensure that future discussions surrounding higher education in Oregon will include all stakeholders. Such a council will bridge the current disconnect in communications between higher education institutions by creating cohesive and independent policy-setting body. Despite the hard work and dedication of our people in our higher education system, it's no secret that we are falling behind national standards. We can no longer afford to leave our students behind. As we all know, higher education is one of the main drivers that will improve our sluggish economy. With the realization that we need to be doing a better job for our students comes the conclusion that there must be an effective starting point. Oregon's current fiscal crisis is forcing us to look at new models of efficiency and partnership. There is a correlation between states that have robust higher education systems and states that have a coordinating council. This bill will put Oregon in the company of states of those states that lead the nation in higher education. Now is the time for new ideas and for new results. Oregon needs to have a more thorough conversation about higher education, and I urge your support and passage of House Bill 2817, and also let you know that my school colors are also orange and black. I, however, graduated from law school at Lewis and Clark College.
They don't have a football team.
They do, but they're not doing very well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Frank Morse, State Senator from District 8, and my district encompasses the Albany-Corvallis area, and I not only represent Oregon State University, but I am a proud alum of that institution as well. I come today to speak in favor of House Bill 2817, and I come with a background that has literally one foot in the public higher education and the other foot in the private education sector. I hold a graduate degree from Oregon State University, and I also hold an undergraduate degree and an honorary degree from Northwest Christian College. And I currently serve as chair of the Board of Trustees of Northwest Christian, and have been on the board for in excess of 20 years. So I do have an appreciation for the issues surrounding the independence and the issues with respect to the public institutions as well. I look at House Bill 2817 as a meaningful recognition of the value that independent colleges and universities play in our state, and the value is significant. I think we overlook sometimes the degree to which the independent colleges and universities play in educating the students of our state. In the independent sector, there's approximately 15% of the state's enrollment, but in the independent colleges and universities, in excess of a third of the graduates come from the independents, including the bachelor's and graduate level degrees earned in our state. So that's a very significant portion of the earned degrees in our state coming from the independent colleges and universities. Another interesting point is that as our public universities are increasingly at capacity, the privates have the capacity to add another 5,000 students approximately to their institutions. One of the misconceptions that comes from the public with respect to public versus private is one that surrounds the income. The perception is that rich kids from rich families go to the private institutions. And in fact, that is not the case. A study that was done several years ago pointed out that the median income for independent colleges showed a lower median income for families supporting students in the independents. And just the reverse of the perception. The average cost for independent students is approximately $29,000, for which 84% receive financial aid, resulting in direct costs to students that is about the same as for direct costs for students in the public institutions. And more than 80% of students at independent colleges complete degrees in 4 years, a much higher rate than exists in the public institutions. So I think the recognition as a matter of public policy of the role that the independents play it has been overlooked in our state, and it's time to elevate the status of the independent colleges and universities to the role that they appropriately play. House Bill 2817 provides an opportunity to thoughtfully evaluate how we can better provide for the needs of higher education in our state. It brings both the public and private institutions into dialogue to search for better answers. And I would suggest to you the most compelling language as I reviewed the bill was with respect to what the task force would do, and the statement that the task force would be required to identify, quote, the most cost-effective and efficient ways of satisfying the post-secondary education needs and desires of all Oregonians. The independent colleges and universities are a very significant partner in providing higher education to the students of Oregon. As a matter of public policy, the public institutions and the independent colleges and universities should be in dialogue to work together to improve higher education in Oregon. House Bill 2817, I believe, is a step in the right direction, and I ask for your support. Thank you very much.
Questions? Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Barber, Dr. Pelton, and Dr. Brandt, please.
Chairman Backlund, members of the committee, my name is J.A. Barber, Jr. I'm the president of Warner Pacific College in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about the proposed legislation before you of the House Bill 2817. I don't want to repeat what you've just heard eloquently expressed by your two colleagues here in support of House Bill 2817, but we're here because we represent the 17 private colleges and universities in Oregon that are a part of the Oregon Independent College Association. These schools, as have already been stated, are providing a good bit of the higher education resource for the state of Oregon, and not only for the state, but we have a number of students who come here to attend our institutions from all over the Northwest, all over the United States, and literally from around the world, being a major contributor to the economy here in the Northwest, in Oregon. We've sensed for some time a need for the Post-Secondary Education Council, the task force, and I know there have been efforts in the past to try to bring this about. But as is many times stated, I don't think there has ever been a time that there has been a greater need for this kind of resource that would involve all of us in Oregon that are involved in providing higher education to students in our state. The issues are clear to us that we need a long-range higher education strategy that better utilizes all of our resources here in Oregon, both public and private, and that focus upon our core objectives, which in the private sector, and I think in the public sector as well, are student access. We want every student who wants to attend a college in Oregon to be able to do that without any limitation, to be able to come, and particularly not because of financial resources. So student access is a core issue. Program choice, institutional quality, cost efficiency, and targeted public investments, and as well as rational planning, are part of what we believe this task force could provide that is not being provided at this point. So we strongly urge you to give positive consideration to this legislation, and I'm going to turn it now to my colleague to my left, your right, speak further.
For the record, my name is Lee Pelton. I'm the president of Willamette University, and I have been president for the last almost 5 years, and I see all these wonderful school ties in front of me, and I must say that I have some associations with a number of you there, not only at Willamette, but Dartmouth and some other places as well. I am here to support House Bill 2817, but I want to say that if I take a little different perspective on this, that while I am a president of an independent college, I come to you really as a citizen of this state and as a citizen who has come to love the state deeply, as a citizen who has three young children who I hope will be educated in the state, and it's from that venue that I want to speak to you. I think now more than ever we need a compelling vision for higher education. We do not have one. And I think this vision for higher education should necessarily cut across all sections, all sectors of higher education in this state. And I must say that this vision does not belong to one president, nor does it belong to one chancellor. One of the great aspects of higher education in this state is the diversity represented by our institutions of higher learning. However, there is no, much to my disappointment as a citizen of this state, there is no venue for developing a common plan for higher education or wrestling a place where we can wrestle with those difficult issues that face us in the future. I think that this this proposal for a council, a task force, is such a good idea that I'm surprised that the good citizens of this state have not adopted it before, and it seems to me that only the self-interested could be opposed to the creation of a task force whose mission is to benefit all of the citizens and the young people of this state. The goals are simple, as you've heard. And there are a number of questions I think that need to be asked and that could be asked in this particular venue. That is to say, how do we connect colleges and universities with economic development in the state? How do we collaborate in a way that builds on the diverse missions and programs of the institutions represented in the state? How do we identify how higher education can be leveraged to meet many of our current and future needs? Shortage in nursing, providing the best teacher education that we can provide, and helping to shore up and develop engineering and sciences and business interests in a way that support the state. And how can we connect K-12 with higher education? And we really need a vision that begins at K, or some would say pre-K, all the way through 16. And we do not have that. And this is an opportunity for us to provide a venue for that. As I said, as a father of three young children, one of whom is almost college age, we all have a stake in higher education in this state. And as you've heard earlier, we far too often, when we think about higher education or discuss higher education, we ignore the tremendous positive impact of our independent universities. And there's an opportunity here through this council to leverage those colleges and universities in a way that they have not been before. So in conclusion, I would ask you to move this bill forward so that we can harness in full measure all of the talent available to us in this state, all of the talent and not just one sector. And let's provide a mechanism that will help us to use the great diversity of our institutions of higher learning on behalf of the state. We have nothing to lose by adopting this bill, and we have everything to gain. So thank you.
Good afternoon, committee members. My name is David Brandt. I'm the president of George Fox University, which is located in Newburgh, well into Representative Backlund's district. So I'm pleased to be here this afternoon to speak to you. I, too, speak on behalf of this bill as the president of one of the private universities in the state of Oregon. Along with President Pelton, I am also a recent Oregonian, having also come just almost 5 years ago, but without small children. So I don't have that particular personal interest to present. But I do believe that Oregon is a tremendously wonderful state. We have come to love it deeply in this short time. As I think about this bill, it seems to me that it is ultimately all about access, cooperation, and money. And I'll try to say a few things about each of those. Access is vital. I think all of us believe deeply that without education, we do not provide adequate citizenry. This is at the core of being Americans in the Great Northwest. And you have seen the statistics that the private institutions really serve an economic spectrum very similar to that served by the state institutions. So it's not a matter that poor students go to the state institutions and rich students go to the private institutions. We all seek to serve Oregonians. The private institutions are an integral part of this state, even though we're not in the state system per se. We live in Oregon. We serve Oregonians. We intend to do that, I think, to our very best ability. And access is central for this. So I believe that to take a statewide look at higher education is crucial for access. The richness of our institutions is astounding. A former president who is not in Oregon anymore, when I first came, I met him and I thanked him for accepting me very generously into the Oregon higher ed scene. And he looked at me and he said, "You know, your institution and my institution are very different, even though we're both private institutions." But he says, "You know, this state needs you as much as it needs me." And I think we can extend that to include the state institutions and have this wonderful spectrum of opportunities for Oregonians. So I think access is essential. Cooperation sometimes seems virtually non-existent in this state. Early in my tenure in Oregon, there was a clandestine meeting. That's supposed to be funny. It really wasn't clandestine, but it was certainly off the record and entirely informal. There was certainly no record kept of that meeting, and the people invited were presidents from both private and public institutions of higher education in the state of Oregon. And as I recall, some 15 people were at dinner that evening. It was a wonderfully rich conversation. But everyone agreed that should some of us be asked in the company of others, whether we had been there, we might deny that we had been there. It seemed, it was also a bit facetious, they said, but it was clear that this group didn't meet on any kind of regular basis to talk, nor did any of our people. It was like as if these segments of higher education didn't get together. I can't imagine, just to echo what President Pelton has said, what we would lose if these segments of higher education began talking with each other, to even get to know each other and possibly appreciate each other in a greater degree. And then there's money. Very little, it's not real cool these days for student aid to be need-based. In our struggle to be high-quality institutions, we tend to aim our institutional aid, and I think this is true in all institutions, to get, as we put it, the finest students available. And I think that's a good thing. However, I believe that public funds ought to be aimed at supporting needy students. That's the purpose, I believe, of state funding for education, for higher education. It ought to support needy students. And we serve needy students in the private sector, as do the public sector institutions. So I believe there's a money issue at that level. And then there's this other money issue of how do we stimulate the economy of the state of Oregon? How do we get things going and make this place work really, really well? I think that can be best done when all Oregonians work together, those at public institutions, those at our institutions, to serve this state with the very finest in education we can possibly project. I appreciate your listening to me. Thank you very much.
Representative Beck.
Yes, yes.
Dr. Jay Barber again. We will be recommending or asking an amendment be introduced to this legislation removing the $500,000 allocation for supporting. We will be removing that. We're going to work together as institutions to raise the funds to undergird the costs for staffing and support of this. We wanted to be sure that you knew that.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's the dash two amendments.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Dr.
May I amplify on something my dear colleague had to say about financial aid, because I think that is a significant issue here. The independent colleges, speak for Willamette, for instance, has a fairly high price tag. And nevertheless, we provide an enormous amount of financial aid to individuals who enroll in our institution. In the fall of this year, I will enroll maybe 500 students or so. For every student who walks through the door and gives me a dollar, I will give them 50 cents back in the form of subsidized aid. And this is aid that is provided to institutions and from private resources. And that contribution to the state and to the state's economy and to providing, as you heard, access and choice for all students who are eligible to attend an institution like Willamette is a tremendous resource for this state. The other thing that I want to say is that nationwide, independent colleges and universities, out of the dollar of aid that they provide to students, that the overwhelming portion of that aid is based on need. At the average college and university, it is 66%. Two-thirds of that is need. The rest is merit. And I can speak for my own institution, where I'm happy to say that more than 70% of the financial aid that we provide is need-based, and a little less than 30% is based on merit. I raise this again just to emphasize that we subsidize through private resources a valuable resource in this state, and that those dollars flow to the state through individual students, and it has a tremendous impact on I think the quality of life in this state.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Duncan Weiss and Harvey Matthews, please.
Chair Backlund, members of the committee, thank you for hearing House Bill 2817. As you know, I'm Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries. We are Oregon's largest business organization with 22,000 members, and we have 325,000 of private employees represented by our association. So we've been a long-time supporter of higher education in the state. Obviously, most of our members come from the state and reap the benefits of having a fine education system. Also, many of our members are alumni, donors, trustees of both private and public institutions in this state. This bill is very similar to House Bill 2015, which this august body passed in 2001. We worked very hard to reach consensus, both with business and the legislature and the universities, community colleges, and student support. So this is seen as the next working of that bill. I think it's very important. What you're doing is continuing on a fine, strong tradition. As you know, education is becoming more expensive and more important to our economy. And Oregon is doing a fairly mediocre job of training our students in post-secondary education. We have about 105% of the national average of our students graduating from high school, which is pretty good. We're 14th in the nation in that way. This is from the 2000 census. But we dropped down to 31st in ranking as far as our students that go on to get an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. That gap is troubling, I think, from a public policy perspective and from an economic development perspective. I think you as the legislature need to be certain that the money that you're appropriating is intelligently appropriated amongst all post-secondary education. And 2817 creates a coordinated approach to higher education. We need to ensure that the most students get the best education for the least amount of money. And AOI supports House Bill 2817. Thank you.
Thank you, members. My name is Duncan Wise. I'm president of the Oregon Business Council. I'm here again to support 2817. I want to thank the committee for hearing it. As Harvey mentioned, a number of us in this room, including three of you I see out here, we spent a lot of time last session on Bill 2015 to take a hard look at post-secondary education governance, and you passed a bill overwhelmingly to do some very important work to examine our resources and try to rationalize them in very important ways. Sadly, that bill was one of the early sacrifices of the budget challenges facing us during the interim, and the commission was never formed because it was never funded. And I think, frankly, we would be a lot better off if it had happened, because the forces that are at work in post-secondary education that we identified last session are still at work. They've been at work for some time, and I think they're still here, and it's very, very urgent that we take a hard look at the entire post-secondary education delivery system and try to think through what model will best suit the needs of Oregon going forward. Let me just briefly touch on why this is so important. In a report we did in 1997 at the Business Council, a report called Higher Ed and the Economy, we identified a number of trends that are just critical for Oregon's economic future. The first is, of course, that higher education, all of post-secondary education, is tremendously linked to Oregon's economic future. It's vital that young people obtain a higher education to be successful. Some form of post-secondary education is vital. And the services that post-secondary education provides in terms of trained workforce as well as research and other services are really critical for the future of the economy. So we have a growing demand, and that demand occurs not just in the early years of life, but at all stages of life as people go back to schools for continuing a lifelong learning. We also noted that the post-secondary world was getting all scrambled up and changing very rapidly. What was once tiny compartments of private, community college, 4 years, were increasingly integrated in new and different ways. You're seeing 4-year programs delivered on community college campuses, private colleges, partnering with public universities, a whole series of arrangements across borders that are really changing the world of post-secondary education. We also saw the need for very nimble, responsive, quick-footed institutions that could quickly identify new opportunities and move very quickly. All those were trends we saw then. We also saw another troubling trend that I think we still see today, and that was in a time of growing demand, there are fewer public resources to serve that demand. And I think that's a reality that we see very starkly here today. But it's a trend that's been going on, frankly, for over a decade in the United States, as this demand grows, state dollars have not kept up with demand for higher education. So in that framework, with those trends, we thought in the report in 1997, and still believe today, that it's time to take a hard look at our vision for post-secondary education. We see the opportunity here in the state with our schools here, the publics and the privates, to offer tremendously great services. But as we looked at those schools, we saw real impediments created by state governance that were getting in the way of those schools to be successful. The most serious impediment, frankly, relates to the OUS system, and you'll be dealing with that this session. The impediments of a system where you basically are treating the OUS system as though it were run solely out of the state government, when in fact state government puts only a small fraction of the resources into that system, yet we still treat it as a state agency. We also saw the problem of balkanized governance. You have three different systems, OUS, community colleges, and independent colleges, all sort of in different worlds in terms of your governing model, even though they're highly interrelated and with no opportunity for coordination. We also saw very different budgeting systems that were used for those three institutions. The community college budget looks very different from the OUS budget, and they're not integrated. And so what we saw in 2015 and what we continue to see in this bill is the opportunity for a framework at the state level to really think through how to most effectively use your post-secondary education resources to the service of Oregonians. As you do that, I think you really need to think about three things in that commission, and I think all those can be tackled in this bill. First of all, how do you create an integrated budget? Recognizing right now you've got, in effect, three separate budgets. We need to think about one budget, we believe, organized around student access and various other functions to procure, you want to procure from post-secondary education. The second is the degree of autonomy and flexibility. You'll be dealing with some of those issues this session, but I think that's a continuing need to talk about what is the right delivery system, how much autonomy do you want to give, in particular the OUS schools, and I think that's a question that needs to be on the table as you look forward. And finally, you need to look at the governance structure at the state level. What is the right way to coordinate and organize your state investment? What kind of governance structure do you need? All these can be addressed in this bill. We identified those in 2015. Again, having a group like this, a Blue Ribbon Committee, to take a hard look at this, I think is just tremendously important to get you set up for the kind of policy choices that I think you're going to want to make. I understand this costs money. That was a problem last time. If you don't fund this bill, I commit to help trying to find resources. I can't promise you anything. We've in the past, the Business Council has been involved in supporting higher ed studies, and I think in the business community, I can't promise you resources, but I think we need to do this with or without the direct state appropriation. I can hope you put some money into this, but I think we need to do this work and let's get on with it, and I hope you can pass the bill. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm Gary Ann Dean, Executive Director of the Oregon Independent College Association. All the testimony that needs to be given in favor has been given, but I wanted to take a moment to explain the other amendment that the committee received this morning. There was a little confusion in legislative council when the bill was drafted. It was very important, I think intuitively obvious, that this task force be neutral, be totally credible with all sectors, and that in my best, wildest dreams, it would consist of all the ex-governors of the state of Oregon. But we may not pull that off. Nevertheless, it was important that the task force be totally neutral of sector interests. So we created, and you'll see it in the bill, a side committee, an advisory committee, on which all the interests can participate. And we meant that there would be one institutional president from each of four sectors, and the way the bill got drafted, it was one institutional president representing all four sectors. So there's an amendment up there that would correct that. The four sectors being the community colleges, the state universities, the independent nonprofit colleges, and the independent for-profit colleges, of which we have some very fine ones in the state. I just wanted to explain that amendment that we're requesting, Senator. Excuse me, Representative Backman. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Duncan, I think this is for you. It was one I was going to ask of OUS more, but you brought up the issue that we are also looking at some increased flexibility options for the system. I don't know if we want to wait and somebody else is going to address that, but I would like to know how you see that being integrated with this particular task force, although I know the focus isn't totally on financial aid and those kinds of things. That has been where the testimony is. I'm more interested in the other areas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Houghton, I agree. I think there are three issues that need to be addressed. That's what, again, you were a strong, I remember participating here in 2015. One of the key issues is the governance, especially of OUS. I mean, at least from our perspective, we think lean, nimble, a governing structure that gives a lot of flexibility at the ground level is really important. That's what we see, why we like the community college model so well, independent college models, and the OUS system has been struggling. And one of the things they brought to you is a bill to provide more flexibility this session. And that, I think, in part came out of the 2015 work that even though that task force wasn't in operation, the chancellor's group focused on that. There will still, even with that bill, I think there will be an ongoing discussion about the level of institutional autonomy of the OUS system. I think that still deserves a very careful look, and I think, I don't know whether you want to put that in this commission. It seems to me the appropriate place to put that question would be in a commission like this, because, again, to me the question is, what does the delivery system look like? What are the institutions, and how do we position them to be most successful on each institution to meeting student and other needs? And then how does the state support those institutions through its budget and regulatory model? So I would hope, and, you know, in 2015 that was part of the conversation, and I think it is important as you take a look at the governance system in Oregon. And it'll be, I know there's a bill working its way through. It's in the Senate, I believe, now, but I hope you'll be seeing that over here. We'll endorse that as well.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Grant and Cairns? Oh, Lisa. Lisa Zavala. Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Sorry that Grant and Cairns was called to a meeting that he had to attend, so I'm going to pitch it for him, I hope. For the record, I'm Lisa Zavala, Associate Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System. I would like to make some comments on House Bill 2817 today. The Oregon University System has, for the past 10 years, has participated in numerous task forces and councils to address post-secondary education in Oregon. The most recent work has conducted has been, and you've heard some of those today. In 1996, Governor John Kitzhaber formed the Task Force on Higher Education and the Economy. There was a Task Force on College Access, and in 1999, the Financial Aid Commission. And the most recent one, which you've heard a little bit about from the previous witnesses, has been the House Bill 2015 from the 2001 legislative session. 2015 created a Post-Secondary Education Opportunity Commission. The commission was charged to develop a budget framework, investigate institutional autonomy and governance, and develop recommendations for how best to support Oregon's community colleges. The commission, however, as you heard, was not funded and therefore never convened. The Oregon Post-Secondary Education Council Task Force, as proposed by House Bill 2817, is a furtherance of the goals to investigate, review, and study statewide post-secondary education planning, coordination, and policies to further coordination to provide seamless education opportunities for Oregonians seeking post-secondary education at all levels of the education spectrum. The Oregon University System welcomes the participation of legislative members, business and industry, educators and students in any and all discussions about the effectiveness and value of higher education in Oregon. The Oregon University System further has no objections to the bill. However, we would prefer to see and would further support the bill if the -1 amendments and the -3 amendments are adopted. I have the -3s. I don't know if you have them in front of you. Thank you. The university system further has no objection to the -2 amendments. However, we may think and we feel that it might seal the fate of the task force. OUS, as you know, has experienced an 11% reduction in its general fund appropriation this biennium. And we face a further 10% general fund reduction in the 03-05 biennium. Simply put, Mr. Chairman, we don't have any money to contribute to this work of the task force. While we have no objection to any task force seeking higher levels of coordination, we believe we currently and presently have all the administrative tools necessary. We just lack the resources. For example, we experience and are participating in dual enrollment programs with community colleges. In particular, for example, is the Oregon State University partnership with Lynn Benton Community College. There are regional collaborative efforts at Eastern Oregon University with Blue Mountain Community College and Treasure Valley Community College. There are university centers located on community college campuses in two locations in the state, Southwestern Oregon Community College down in Coos Bay and the Central Oregon Community College in Bend. There is a branch campus of the OSU on the campus of the Central Oregon Community College in Bend. There is the Joint Boards Articulation Commission that works on articulation issues with community colleges and post-secondary education. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the -3 amendments that we're proposing puts the decision makers at the table and recognizes the need to empower them in the deliberative process as a task force develops recommendations to the 2005 legislature. They should not be set off to the side of the process. They need to be included in it. And I would welcome any questions. Thank you very much.
Lisa, I have a question. You've delineated a number of examples of cooperation or collaboration between community colleges and the OUS.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any reaction to the presidents who testified that they would like more dialogue with the OUS?
My reaction would be I certainly believe that that would be of value. I think that any type of collaborative efforts, communication, and post-secondary education in Oregon is essential. One thing I did notice as I was running off some of those examples, at some of our university centers in Central Oregon, for example, there are some private institutions that offer courses at those locations as well. So there is some of that effort as well.
Mm-hmm. So there's some precedent for that, and it could be expanded, and that would be a good thing.
And I believe that the precedent has been set with the Financial Aid Commission. There was some serious dialogue about financial aid issues among the sectors, and in the deliberation and with House Bill 2015, however, unfortunately, it was not funded.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
By the way, Lisa, you pinch hit very well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Andrea.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Oregon Community College Association, which represents the 17 community colleges in Oregon. I'm here today to raise some of the concerns that we have regarding House Bill 2817. But let me start by saying that we are very supportive of efforts to increase collaboration among post-secondary institutions in Oregon. We believe that there has been quite a great deal of collaboration in the past. We know there's always room for improvement, but we are we believe that we've done a good job in working with both OUS and with the private institutions. And I wanted to give you a couple of examples on that. One, the community colleges have worked closely to make sure that the transfer degree from community colleges is transferable. Many of our students who get an associate's degree transfer both to OUS institutions and to private institutions in the state. Secondly, many of our community colleges work not only with OUS, but the private independent and the for-profit institutions to create partnerships to offer services to the students on their campuses. For example, at Chemeketa hosts 7 different institutions who have space on their campus where a student can stay at Chemeketa and get a degree from 7 different institutions, including several of the OUS institutions, PSU, OSU, and EOU, private institutions such as Linfield, and the University of Phoenix. So there is a great deal of coordination now between the community colleges and the other segments of education in Oregon. We do have some very specific concerns about this bill, specifically in the direction that's given to the task force. We're most concerned on page 2 of the bill, line 21 through 27, and the direction given to the task force. to identify positive outcomes that might derive from linking or merging some of Oregon's existing state agencies into a statewide post-secondary education policy council. We're very concerned about this because of the impact that it may have on Oregon's community colleges. While we would support any type of post-secondary education policy council that's coordinated between the different institutions, we would not be supportive of anything that eliminated the existing state agencies and put them all into one post-secondary education policy council. Our community colleges currently are governed on the state level by the Board of Education. We have in the past been very happy with this in that structurally our community colleges are created most similar to the K-12 institutions in the state. Our community colleges are originally throughout the K-12 system and structurally are governed by local boards, receive local property taxes, and have local bonding authorities. So we've been very pleased with the, in the past, with how it has worked with the Board of Education because of that similarity with K-12. We would be concerned on any change on the state level in the governance structure because our concern is that it would impact the local control that community colleges currently have. And we believe that's one of the greatest strengths of community colleges is having locally elected boards to make decisions on a local level so that they can be very responsive to their local community's needs. As stated before, we do support coordination on a statewide level. Our concern is that any kind of coordination be done and with the recognition of the important role of the local control of the boards of community colleges. Because of that, we do have some amendments on the bill, the Dash 1 amendments, which I believe you have a copy of. And in those, we make two specific changes. First, on line 21 of the bill, we would ask that the word positive be deleted, as we believe there would be negative outcomes as well if a statewide post-secondary education policy council were created. And we would want the task force to look at both the positive and negative outcomes that may derive from that change. Secondly, line 27 of the bill, we would like added into it that the task force would take into consideration the impact the changes would have on the local control of community colleges, because we believe that is a very important value and needs to be taken into consideration when looking at any kinds of change in statewide governance. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andrea, help me make sure that I'm understanding what you're saying. I tried to listen to the concerns that you had and certainly appreciate them, but they primarily focus on the fact that this might have some changes that would throw you into a pot, so to speak, governing all post-secondary education.
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson, that's correct. It's a specific language in the direction to the task force that directs them to identify the positive outcomes of merging Oregon's existing state agencies into a post-secondary education council. But we're not opposed to the idea of having a post-secondary education council. It's just that if that post-secondary education council were to replace the existing governance structure that we have, more our concerns come into play.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Vakian.
Do either of you have any concerns about the possibility of public monies making their way to private institutions through the efforts of this task force, as in student financial aid, that might follow the student?
Take a shot at that. Chair Backlund, Representative Vakian. Currently, there is financial aid money that does go to private institutions. I'm not as familiar with that issue, but my understanding is through the Oregon Student Assistance Commission that there is specific money that goes not only to private institutions, it funds community colleges, OUS, and private institutions. I do know there is a differentiated amount for each one. If community college receives the least amount, it's based on a percentage of the cost. So that those that go to private institutions receive a greater amount of the money than those who go to OUS or community colleges. We certainly haven't had any internal conversations specifically on this bill as to how that would affect financial aid.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would just answer as well. Everything that Andrea said is in fact true. That's the way I understand it as well. In terms of a concern about that, Mr. Chair, I think that's state policy, and we would defer to this able body to make those types of determinations.
Yeah, I think the Oregon Opportunity Grants that are now in place were determined in 1997. And right now we're funding, based on need, 11% of the cost. And, of course, the costs vary between community colleges, the OUS, and private universities.
Private not-for-profit universities.
Private not-for-profit, independent, what I should have said. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is Cam Price Frawley here? Oh, she is indeed.
Chair Backron and members of the committee, for the record, Cam Price Frawley, Commissioner of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Since this since House Bill 2817 does affect the department and community colleges, I wanted to add my voice to the amendments that have been mentioned by both Ms. Zavala and Ms. Henderson, and that we are in support of those and interested in pursuing a task force that looks at this issue. As was mentioned, House Bill 2015 did pass. It was not begun because of a lack of resources. So it remains a lingering question whether there are, in fact, efficiencies or other things that we could that could be produced by further study of post-secondary education. And I would add my voice to there. Happy to take any questions.
Okay, so Cam, you're talking specifically about the Dash 1 amendment.
And Dash 3.
And Dash 3. Okay, very good. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I appreciate very much hearing the information that we've heard. We have three amendments to consider. I guess it's my inclination to reflect on these a bit and not go to work session at this point. If there's a strong feeling to do otherwise, I would certainly entertain that, however. But if we're not sure as to the direction we ought to proceed as a committee, I think probably we can come back another time and pursue this. So, hearing no comments to the contrary, excuse me, Representative Hobson.
Mr. Chair, I concur with you. I'm very much more favorably inclined now that there's no money. That $500,000 had concerned me a little bit, I think, the last time that we heard this, but I think it would be a good idea to bring it back together and look at it.
Okay. With that, then, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2817. Committee, we'll move to the top of our schedule today and open a work session on House Bill 3603. And Jim, maybe you want to update us as to what we need to do today.
Yes, sir. House Bill 3603 was a bill we dealt with last Wednesday, and we're going to be moving it to the Health and Human Services. When we got ready to drop the bill, we discovered that the motion was not exactly right, so we are bringing it back to have the rule suspended, the motion reconsidered, and a new motion, so we can move it on to Health and Human Services.
Yeah, last time, I think, committee, we were given the impression that we needed to move that House Bill 3603 very quickly to Health and Human Services so that they could consider the bill in connection with two others. And they had thought it would be on Friday of last week. Well, it turned out that it's not on Friday, and so we are fine in terms of time, but we need to do it right. So with that in mind, the chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and reconsideration of House Bill 3603 be taken up immediately. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Chair requests unanimous consent that the motion to send House Bill 3603 to the Committee on Health and Human Services without recommendation be reconsidered. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House Bill 3603 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services without recommendation and then to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Hobson moves that House Bill 3603 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services without recommendation and then to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? Gina, could you call roll, please?
Yes.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye. The bill receives the constitutional authority. It passes, and with that, we don't need a carrier, so we will just declare it passed. Okay. We will open a public hearing on H.J.R. 41. Jim.
Yes, sir. H.J.R. 41 pledges continued support of and participation with Oregon Public Affairs Network.
Okay. We have Rick Hansen. And a group of others. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Backlund, members of the committee. My name's Rick Hansen. I'm the Executive Director of OPAN, the Oregon Public Affairs Network. And we're here in support of H.J.R. 41. I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves.
For the record, my name is John Gradenis, Director of Distance Learning for the Oregon University System and Director of the Oregon Wireless Instructional Network.
Okay, for the record, I'm Kurt Pedersen, Vice Provost for Information Services, and when I went to my closet this morning, I forgot my beaver tie, and I'm embarrassed.
Okay. So we're here in support of H.J.R. 41, which you should have in front of you. The resolution is fairly self-explanatory in that it simply expresses support for the Oregon Public Affairs Network. We want to tell you a bit about why we'd like your support for this resolution and why it's important. And to do that, we really have to tell you a little bit about OPAN and how it works. So we'll take a few minutes to do that. To fully explain OPAN and the concepts really takes about an hour, so we're going to condense it into a few minutes, and then we'll take your questions.
Excuse me, Rick. I might add, committee, that Rick told me that he has an hour-long version, or he has a five-minute version. So we're going to be hearing the five-minute version today.
Right. So that might raise a lot of questions. We think that's probably the most effective way to go.
That's
good. OPAN is, in effect, a C-SPAN for Oregon. We distribute public affairs programming to about 400,000 households statewide. And the program mix is very similar to what you'd see on C-SPAN. The viewing experience is like that. The idea is that, in essence, we have a third to a half of the programming is government programs that come off the Capitol Mall, and then the remainder are programs that are produced by other public affairs partners. So, tonight, for example, on OPAN, you will see this hearing and some others. Tomorrow night, you'll probably see another legislative hearing. Wednesday night, you might see somebody who spoke at the City Club of Eugene last week, or a speaker on one of the campuses of the universities who are our partners. And we think that it's very important to offer this service. We're doing it as a 501c3. And while there are about 20 other states that have similar type public affairs networks, there are very few that are doing it the way we're doing it, which is as a collaborative partnership. And we'll talk, John will talk a little bit more about how those partnerships work. But it is the fundamental reason that we're here seeking your support for this resolution is because the way we have constructed this organization is that OPAN is a facilitator. It's a front end that we have created to promote and market and facilitate getting programs out to Oregonians. And then on the back end, there are a lot of partnerships that make that possible, and the legislature is one of those key partners. And so it's important to have your expression of support as well as your full participation in what we're doing. I'll turn it over to John now, I guess, to talk for a few moments about how the operations work.
Sure. Again, for the record, John Gardenis, Oregon University System. And as Rick mentioned, this really is a partnership. And in your packet, I think there's a list of some of the key partners that are involved. And OPAN really does provide the kind of the catalyst or the framework. It provides a logistics and a promotion for letting each of the partners do something they couldn't do individually. So it really is a synergy that allows this network to operate. But again, some of the key partners, as Rick mentioned, is the legislature, legislative media here. I'm sure all of you use that service internally to keep track of what's going on in the building as you're here. OPAN is able to take that service that you use and extend it out to the public. So now we're reaching 400,000 homes by using programming produced here that you support here. So legislative media is a critical part of this. OPAN through Oregon Wind is located at the OSU campus. So Oregon State University provides a lot of production, routing, and technical support that allows the network to operate. In exchange, OSU's we have access to OSU students. Students have some access to the real-world production over here in the area. Then Oregon University System through Oregon Wind. Oregon Wind is basically a network that provides a distribution here in the valley. It's an educational network that, again, gauge benefit having the program dispersed through the public access channels. And again, the public access channel is the last mile connection to get directly into people's homes. So that's the basic operation of it. We pull programming, as I mentioned, from the legislature here, but also from many lecture series and seminars and events are held on the campuses, including private institutions, the OUS institutions. And we work with City Co. Eugene, City Co. Portland, and other producers of public affairs programming. So we can carry the debates. We carry the Measure 28 debate that actually originated from Klamath Falls. So we have a real school resource from a lot of different people. And I'm going to have Kurt just talk a little about OSU's involvement.
For the record, again, it's Kurt Pedersen, Vice Provost, Information Services with Oregon State University. Why did Oregon State get involved? We took a look at the Oregon Public Affairs Network when it was sort of struggling to continue its existence and its mission and its vision, and said there's some alignment there with a statewide public service component that we have. Oregon State University is a land-grant university. It leveraged on some existing partnerships. We already had a partnership with OUS and what we call the Wireless Instructional Network, so we were already a hub for video broadcast in the state, probably a little-known fact. We have an opportunity to cover the cost of some time that I'm already paying to some network technicians, so it helped me from a budget standpoint. We also, through the partnership, because we're reimbursed and we receive revenue, we're able to go out and buy some cutting-edge media editing equipment. In past sort of broadcasts of legislative media sessions, it was sort of like all or nothing. They were not condensed, sort of the best of what you could get, and the captioning wasn't very good, and you didn't always know what you were watching, and you couldn't get to the part that you wanted to watch during the day. In the future, this editing equipment will be able to hopefully archive the signal, store it, index it, so a legislator, a citizen, a student could go to a particular testimony or session and find maybe the testimony that was previous today from one of the university presidents. OPAN also is very supportive of internships. Having our OSU students involved in the broadcast, the distribution, the editing, sort of the collaboration that's involved in getting some real-world experience. The current hybrid model that we have with the legislative media, the OPAN, the Oregon University System, the Wireless Instructional Network, and OSU is an outstanding example of how people can get together to solve a problem and leverage very limited resources without having to spend the type of dollars they've spent in many other states. And it's without hesitation that President Risser, initially, and now President White, support the Oregon Public Affairs Network and House Joint Resolution 41. Thank you.
So I'd like to just circle back, if I could, for just a moment. We've explained a little bit about how this works. The partnerships, the how this works, really, we could talk to you about for a very long time, because that is what it makes the Oregon Public Affairs Network very distinct, and why it's so much less expensive than it is in any other state. In Washington State, they spend $2.2 million a year to do what we're planning to do for $300,000 a year. The state of Wisconsin is now doing it. I just talked to them. They're going to hire 22 people and spend $1.5 million a year. And we're, again, doing it for, you know, a third in terms of staff, FTE, even though none of them actually work for OPAN because of this contractual relationships, and for about a fifth of the cost. So it's those partnerships that get very important. And if you look at page 2 of your handout, we've sort of done a very simple summary of how it works. That these different partners who are already, in most cases, producing content, and already in most cases filming it, are simply providing that to us. And that's certainly the case here with the legislature. They're already taping things, and they're simply providing us that material so we can run it. Now, there's another final sort of important point to mention before we open up to your questions, and that is why this is important. And I think probably people in this room have a pretty good sense of how important it is to connect with your constituents. But it's worth reiterating that, you know, in a democracy, we obviously find this very, very important to have constituents know what's going on in their government. When people understand what's going on, it makes, I think, your jobs easier. It makes the public more understanding, in effect, of the challenges that you face here every day in this body. So we think that having that access is an essential component of democracy. We now can do it very inexpensively, and we've proven it in the last year that it's possible. We're now up to 5 nights a week, as well as the day-long broadcast. If you look on the last page of your handout, you'll see where we are currently on the times that we're broadcasting. And so we would ask your support for HGR 41, and can take any questions you have.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a wonderful program, and I guess I ask, are there any plans to expand it, of course, without any money?
Members of the committee, Representative Hobson, that is one of the fundamental challenges. We set out to establish the network and prove that it could be done. Even our colleagues in other states said the model you're using won't work. Well, we've made it work. And proven that it can be done. And the only challenge now is simply a financial challenge. We do have to, in this first year, we have about $150,000 budget. But ultimately, a built-out program only costs $300,000 a year. Our objective, we've been working off of gifts from individuals and foundations, and our objective is to expand the base next to seek underwriting for particular types of programs. And so we've got 3 or 4 areas we can expand our development efforts into. And again, because we're very small and bootstrapping this, we're expanding them one at a time. Expansion will come once we've stabilized our existing operations. And we do have the ability to expand statewide, to reach every community in the state. It doesn't cost that much money, but we have set that conversation aside, so we really need to focus on stabilizing what we're doing now.
Very good. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks.
That concludes those, or the list of those who have signed up. So we will close the public hearing on HJR 41, and we'll open a work session on HJR 41.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Farr.
Mr. Chair, I move House Joint Resolution 41 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Farr moves House HJR 41 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Well, I think this is a measure that we can feel pretty good about. Call the roll, please, Gina.
Aye.
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 Aye. The bill passes unanimously. We need a carrier. Volunteer? Representative Farr will carry it. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll close the work session on HJR 41, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3430. Jim, are you ready?
Yes, sir. House Bill 3430 directs the Quality Education Commission to adopt standards and identify best practices for providing basic education. Directs the Superintendent of Public Instruction to estimate the cost per student of providing basic education. Becomes operative if the revision to the Oregon Constitution proposed by HJR 45-2003 is approved by voters. Makes technical statutory changes to reflect revisions of the Oregon Constitution by HJR 45-2003 if the resolution is approved by the voters, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Okay. Thank you very much. Do we have anyone sign up to testify?
No, sir.
Okay. Well, we have no one signed up. Interesting situation. Any comments?
Mr. Chair,
I did not sign up,
but I'd like to give an overview.
Please.
I've been asked what these two pieces of legislation are attempting to accomplish.
Okay, excellent.
I might.
You bet.
Unless, of course, as the other co-chief sponsor, you would like to carry this conversation.
Well, Representative Nolan, in that you were so persuasive and convinced me that I should join you in this effort, I think I will defer to your expertise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary Nolan, I'm State Representative for Southwest Portland, House District 36. I do appreciate, Mr. Chair, that you have co-sponsored both of these companion pieces of legislation with me. And I present them to the committee. I had hoped, actually, to present them both to the same committee because there is some benefit in considering them simultaneously. Although, as I look at the membership here, several of you will have the opportunity later this week to consider House Joint Resolution 45, which Chair Shetterly has told me he intends to schedule for a public hearing as well. And I bring these two pieces of legislation to your attention and for consideration, frankly, with a bit of mixed emotion, because the premise behind them is that the legislature and the voters, but I think largely it is the legislature, have not been able to fund the quality education model that the Oregon voters have approved and embodied in our Constitution. And while I continue to believe that that is the direction we should take our K through 12 system, I think we need to call the question. If we are not going to fund that level of education this biennium, what system of educational achievement do we want to have throughout the state? And the two pieces of legislation, House Bill 3430, which is before this committee, and House Joint Resolution 45, working together, and as you noticed, there are cross-references in them. This bill does not become effective, even if passed, unless the resolution is referred to the voters and approved by the voters. But together, these two pieces of legislation would set a floor for academic performance. They do not set a floor for an actual dollar amount, but consistent with the concept of a quality education model, which defined academic outcomes that we expect as a matter of policy from our K through 12 system. These two pieces would define, consistent with the framework of the quality education model, a basic education. and define what that would mean in terms of academic performance and the necessary support services within a school and within a school district to achieve that academic outcome. They would make this floor consistent statewide. They together would squarely place responsibility for funding this basic educational outcome on us, on the state legislature. And then, this is the part that frankly gives me some mixed emotion and some hesitation, but I think it is a reflection of the way we have actually handled the question, and I think we need to say it out loud. The two pieces would acknowledge that there are differing local perspectives and local commitments to education. And I chose my words rather pointedly to say different and not higher or lower, because I think it is appropriate for us to acknowledge that while a system of education throughout the state should have common elements in every corner of the state, it is possible to have appropriate educational policy decisions made in one community that differ from the decisions made in another community, without passing judgment as to whether one of those decisions is better or higher quality than another. They're just different. One community may place a top priority on computer sciences. Another community may place top priority on natural resource management. And those are both valid choices for those communities, but may not necessarily be ones that are valid and appropriate and, frankly, affordable statewide. And finally, in the companion piece, and not in this bill before us, but the resolution would allow local control of the education program and performance through voter approval of funding for educational programs and services that are not within the basic education that this bill would define. And I bring them to you, and I appreciate your help in bringing them, Mr. Chair, so that we can have a conversation about what we really are committed to providing for K-12 education, and what we believe, which parts of that we believe should be consistent statewide, and where, if at all, the legislature would tolerate some differences among local communities. And I'll take questions.
Representative Hobson.
Is anyone talking today?
Oh, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to see or hear from you the relationship between the ability to have differences around the state and the local control and the charge to the Quality Ed Commission and the Quality Ed model to take a good hard look at the funding piece of that, of the program, a basic educational program. Because the Quality Ed model and the commission now come up with actual prototypical types of funding. How would you see that interacting with what you're proposing here? Would there be some potential for changes around the state in regard to the funding as well?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hobson, I think we're doing that. And I think we should do it in a thoughtful, thoughtful manner that relates the choices, that actually guides the choices we make by educational outcomes, rather than have the situation that we've faced in the current biennium and potentially facing in the next biennium, where the funding level tends to be a factor of political will rather than be driven by the desired educational outcome. And we should call the question of, for example, I know how I'd be on it, but I think we should call the question of whether we, in fact, are committed to 180 days of instructional service for our students statewide. Is that a minimum that we are committed to because of what it delivers in academic accomplishment for the students? And if we are, then we should follow through and find a way to do it. And if we're not, we should understand the educational consequences of that in terms of children's ability to meet the benchmarks, children's ability to progress through the curriculum.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm. And please correct me if I'm missing something conceptually here. Right now the QEM gives you X number of dollars as a suggested prototype, and the districts have local control as to whether they have two counselors and three reading assistants or those kinds of changes in there, and the amount of money it would take to afford that. Are you suggesting in this that some school district, let's take Portland, it's always fun to pick on them, Portland could say, well, we're not going to have the targets for the accomplishment in reading, and therefore we're going to take some of the money away from there, but it absolves us of the responsibility of meeting the standards that the state has in that?
That's not my intention. Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, it is not my intention to allow through these measures a district to violate or ignore state standards. But it is my intention to apply a consistent standard and acknowledge that we're not meeting the quality education model. The quality education model is framed around outcomes, and the way it translates ends up being, we talk about it in the shorthand of dollars per ADMW, but the quality education model starts with a framework of an educational attainment at different grades, a percentage of students achieving that level of academic accomplishment, the resources in terms of classroom staff, in terms of counseling staff, instructional materials, and all of those things that it typically takes to achieve that. And then, as you point out, allows districts some flexibility in delivering it, but it's framed around the outcomes. The concept here is to use that same structure, but perhaps to acknowledge that if we are not going to fund the quality education model, and as much as I would love to, I do not see any hope that this legislature is going to fund the quality education model this session. We're $1.5 billion short of it, and I do not see any reason to believe that that money will suddenly be appropriated before we sine die. If we are not going to, then we should define what we expect from school districts in terms of educational outcomes, not merely in terms of dollars committed.
Representative Hobson and Representative Nolan, it seems to me too that the bill is very clear in the importance of following the No Child Left Behind Act.
Mm-hmm.
So, in Representative Hobson's example, which was reading, the No Child Left Behind Act makes very clear that there's a Reading First program, and that that our students have to be on level, grade level for reading. And so it looks to me like we're kind of talking about we have the big parameters, and then there's enough local control to meet them within the big picture here, at least maybe by design or by goal.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, it is not by accident that the two pieces of legislation are integrally linked. I could not begin to consider supporting House Bill 3430 absent House Joint Resolution 45. It would go against everything that brings me to this activity. But I'm interested in finding ways to allow citizens to take control of this issue for themselves, and that's what House Joint Resolution 45 would do.
Mm-hmm. And finally, one last comment, too, on House Bill 3430. It seems to me that this may elevate the status of, or the importance of, or maybe people's awareness of the Quality Education Commission. I think that's kind of an inside game as far as the general awareness of it, and so this bill, I think, might accomplish that at the same time.
I hope so, Mr. Chair.
Oh, very good. Well, thank you very much, Representative. And you explained it beautifully, and I think we all appreciate that.
Thank you for your support.
With that, then, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3430. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2744. And I see our legislative counsel who has written the bill, and I think 14 amendments.
Okay.
Cindy Hunt is here to talk about... Oh, maybe 15, I'm being told. No, 14, okay. Yeah, I think, members, we were, last time, had a nice matrix, an excellent matrix developed by Cindy and by our committee administrator, Jim Keller, and it basically compared the amendments -6, -9, and -10, and since that time, we have obviously added a number of others. As we get input, we have further considerations, and we want to do this right. So we're up to -14. So Cindy, if you want to take the floor and talk to us, we're anxious.
Okay, Cindy Hunt, Legislative Counsel's Office. Would you like me to proceed to talk about, for example, starting with the -11, which is where we left off? Or do you want to just talk about, specific amendments?
I think, Cindy, the -7 and the -11 can stand alone.
That's
on their own. And and I think when we get all this put together, I don't think we'll have any difficulty in understanding those or, frankly, in moving those. The matrix that I'm looking at here, as I said, goes particularly to 6, 9, and 10. So we can, I think, the -11 deals with... the subject matter is, and also, I guess, if I'm understanding it correctly, the -12 is embedded into -14. Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Chair Backlund, you're correct. To review, the -7 amendments, what they focused on was the work sample student portfolio issue. And... what they did was remove references to work samples and student portfolios from a requirement of the Certificate of Initial Mastery. What they also did was specifically direct the State Board of Ed and the school districts that they may not require the creation of a student portfolio as part of the requirements of the SIM. So then what the -11s do is pick up from that. And so they have the requirements I just mentioned for the -7s, but then they also add a requirement that says to the State Board of Ed that they need to establish a minimum number of work samples that a student must complete in each subject to receive a SIM, and then allows a school district to go beyond that minimum number upon approval of the Department of Ed.
Okay, now, committee, my feeling about this is one of our goals in House Bill 2744 was to find ways to relieve schools and certainly teachers of regulatory burdens or mandated burdens. And it seems to me that the Dash 7 and the Dash 11 would accomplish that. So we have no portfolio requirements for SIM and the 1. And we struggle with the work sample issue, and we've gone through several iterations of it. And it seems, at least I'm convinced, that that to make the assessments really work, we need work samples. It would be unrealistic to provide the statewide assessments with no prior work samples, if nothing else, for practice. And so this is the genesis of the Dash 11. And that's very recent. That's since Friday. Is that not right, Jim? Yeah, since Friday. So, anyway, some background there. Go on, please. Yeah.
And then the next amendments to be prepared was the Dash 12. And what those are is they're the same as the Dash 9. So if you look at your flow chart, you can kind of give an idea of what the Dash 9s did. They were the amendments that added health to the requirements for academic content standards, among other things. Mm-hmm. And what the only difference between the Dash 12s and the Dash 9s is that they restore some language in the SIM. And I'm going to read the language when I find it. Okay. So if you have the Dash 12s in front of you on page 9, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Oh, excuse me, yes, Representative Nolan.
It might be my fault, but I don't think I have a copy of a Dash 12 amendment.
I don't think I do either, do we?
Well, no, we'd moved on to 13 and 14 to replace the 12, so we didn't bring the 12.
Okay. But we'll ignore the Dash 12.
Okay, good,
for
good. So we'll line this out.
Set those aside.
Okay.
Okay. So,
Representative Hobson made a comment that she doesn't feel so bad now. So. good, okay.
Sorry about that.
No, that's fine.
Okay, so moving on to the Dash 13s. The Dash 13s are like the Dash 10s, which were kind of like the Dash 8s. And so the 13s, let me remind you that what those did is they directed the State Board to adopt academic content standards in various subjects except for health. Health was treated differently. And then they also directed for purposes of the SIM that the State Board was to adopt requirements in, of course, math, science, and English, but also history, geography, PE, arts, and second languages, but that a school district could choose to implement the SIM in the other subjects that weren't math, science, and English. And then health was not added to the SIM. And then as far as, I don't think there was a difference with the statewide assessments. So then what the Dash 13 did was it restored some language, and I believe that's in the SIM, and it's probably, it is page 9. Mm-hmm. And the language it restored was the following sentence. It says, this is part of the SIM, students shall be allowed to collect credentials over a period of years culminating in a project or exhibition that demonstrates attainment of the required knowledge and skills that have been measured by a variety of valid assessment methods. And that's on lines 11 to 14 on page 9.
Yeah. I believe, committee, with our Dash 6, 9, and 10, we had excluded that sentence,
yes,
thinking that it was a reference to the portfolio.
Right.
We have since discovered or learned that that's not the case, that this was designed to allow individual students to be able to pass an assessment without doing really well on the test, on the assessment itself. And I think that's a good idea because it doesn't make the assessment such a high stake test, so to speak. So we wanted to put that back. Once we figured that out, we wanted to put that back and allow individual students to do well without doing well on the assessment itself. Representative Hobson.
Mr. Chair, does that mean, in other words, this was an alternative method to achieve a SIM?
Representative Hobson, I would say the answer is yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, that's 13.
That's 13. Moving.
So, oh, excuse me, Representative.
Just to make sure I've got the scorecards filled out correctly. The dash 13 is most similar to
the 10.
The 10,
which are similar to the 8.
Gotcha.
If you're looking down your flowchart,
mm-hmm. And the key difference is that
that's
the restoration is
the only
retention of that language. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Ockham.
It also does it not, and you may have said this, I'm sorry if I missed it. It keeps separate the, in section 4 on page 6, it keeps separate the health requirement so that it does not dictate that the department create standards for health.
You're correct, Representative Avakian, that's true. It treats health the same way as the dash 10s and the dash 8 treated health. And so, yes, health is set apart and is not at the level of the other subjects. It's so they're not directed to the academic content standards for health. Okay, so then the 14s are sort of a combination of different amendments. And so what they do is, again, they're a gut and stuff of the entire bill. And then for purposes of our academic content standards, health is added to those other subjects. So they're like the dash nines in that regard, in that the department is directed to adopt academic content standards in health. And then for purposes of the SIM, over on pages 9 and 10, they basically use parts of the 13s, the 10s, the 8s. And what they do is they direct the state board to adopt for the SIM requirements for math, science, English, history, geography, economic, civics, PE, health, the arts, and second languages. And then what they say to the school district is that they have to implement the SIM in math, science, and English, but any subjects beyond that are optional. Now, the one change that these do that the 13s, 10s, and 8s did not is that health is added to this list. And the reason for that is that earlier in this bill draft, health was added to the academic content standard list and treated the same as the other subjects. So that's carried forward. But it's a policy choice whether or not to add it also to SIM, but that seemed to be logical given it was added to the academic content standards.
And so right now, Cindy, health does not have state standards written.
State standards, no.
And then dash 14 would provide for that.
Yes. Okay. Correct. And then the 14s, as far as the assessments and so forth, are the same as the other amendments, in that it requires statewide assessment, math, English, science, history, mm-hmm. geography, mm-hmm. civics. That's what you have before you.
Okay. Well, as usual, you've been very helpful. And again, I'd like to thank you, Cindy, for coming in, and also both you and Jim for working on our matrix. This has been very helpful. Okay. I think I hate to use the strong verb like zipped through this. I don't think we zipped through it. I think we're plowing through it. But we're not prepared to move it yet. I think on Wednesday we'll be in good shape. I think we now have time to really analyze this and think about this, and I think that's a good thing. We want to do it right. But before I adjourn, I understand that Ozzy Rose has some comments to make for us. So, Ozzy, if you would come up. Oh, Bob. Bob Wilmer, you come up too, please. Yeah, sorry. Fine, yeah. It's fine with me.
Fine if we're hitting it. You know what's rolling. I mean, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzy Rose, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I think these chairs are very comfortable myself. But we had our Education Policy Commission meeting last week of our membership, and there were 18 people there from across the state, and we plowed through all this stuff, and we are preparing a letter for the state board supporting the thrust of what you people are doing and what the board has done. There was one issue that came up that I'd like you to give consideration to, and there was concern that the SIM should be the same in every school district, and you get a SIM in the core subject areas, and that it would be better nomenclature if then you've got a SIM endorsement or an endorsement in these other areas to add to your SIM, so that a SIM that comes out of Reynolds is the same SIM that comes out of Portland, the same one that comes out of Eugene, rather than...
Okay, that means those same three subjects.
Right, yeah. So that's what a SIM is. And then an endorsement of some kind that I, as a youngster, could decide I wanted to add to my SIM, but based on the high standards assessment, we're supporting all of that, that the state does that. And the other subject, which doesn't need legislation, but to try to give you a flavor how the discussion was went, a discussion, does this mean that if a student wants a SIM in physical education or a second language, then the district has to offer a SIM? No, what the district has to do is prepare the opportunity for the youngster to, and so I choose to pursue it in my district, somebody else pursues something else, and the district's going to have to start looking at how do you get the experiences that get me to the position to, so I can pass the exams or whatever it takes to get it. Doesn't mean that the district's got to revamp its curriculum and offerings, et cetera, and everything's got to change. They got to sit down and work with me as I build my education profile and so forth. And I think the thought process where you're responding where the students want to go is the value of all the discussion we've had the last 10 years and where we finally are. That's all I've had, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure what to do with the language, but the concept of an endorsement added to your SIM is what we're trying to get to.
Representative Hobson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that your intent here, the feedback that you got from your representatives, was that it might be somewhat confusing to say I have a SIM, meaning the core SIM as we have referred to it before, then in addition I have a SIM in health, a SIM in whatever, which you would say would be I have a SIM endorsement or something like that. You know? So we're just talking verbiage here rather than concept.
No. Madam Chair, Representative Hobson, I think the answer to your question is yes. But what they were trying to say is, Ozzie Rose says, I've earned a SIM. Every place in Oregon, that means the same thing. A SIM means those core subjects. But Ozzie Rose also says, I earned a SIM with an endorsement in dot, 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 dot. And so my SIM with endorsements is different than my colleagues who put all this extra time in health, and I put all my extra time in foreign languages.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Avakian.
Do your folks want us to make sure the SIM is offered in math, science, English only, or to ensure that it's offered in all of the subjects that are listed in this bill, which would mean we would take out the may, that they may be offered, which would lead to the inconsistency amongst the districts? Do you want assurances that all the subjects will have a SIM attached to it?
Mr. Chair, I want the shall and may to say the same. I just want what you may offer is an endorsement to your SIM. So there's a clear delineation over what a SIM means. So the SIM earned in Reynolds is the same SIM that's earned in Eugene and so forth. And that's the SIM is the core subjects. The additional endorsements that I may earn are the what I've created out of a SIM, and that's beyond what a SIM is, an endorsement to my SIM.
Ozzie, your approach, it looks like, is you've left it up to the student to decide if he or she wants to pursue these other subjects, the endorsement subjects. And I think the bill to date has basically said school districts can make those optional. My thought would be if a school district said it can make it optional, the school board could choose that all students will be responsible, say, for second language. And that's a different concept than what you're talking.
Ms. Chair, but the point would still be the same for what we were trying to discuss is the school district in Reynolds could choose to make second language a part of their SIM requirements, and then that SIM is different than the SIM somewhere else. And that's what we were trying to get around. The SIM is what it is, and if Reynolds decides to add the second language to their requirements that all their students take, then their students will earn a SIM with an endorsement in foreign language. Mm-hmm. We were trying to get the same nomenclature, so SIM means the same thing everywhere.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow up. Yeah.
Would that mean then that I could not get an endorsement in foreign language, per se, to say, if I had not already achieved a SIM in math, science, or English? Does one attach to the other?
I think, Mr. Chair, the answer would be no. It does not attach. I could earn the endorsement for a SIM and say, look, I got the foreign language endorsement for a SIM, but I did not earn a SIM because I didn't score well enough or do well enough in the three core areas.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. We kind of had this conversation.
We did.
About how to put the two things together that made sense to a whole host of people, and I really like what you're doing with this. In fact, to me, it points a little bit more in the direction of the SIM and endorsements being meaningful once you get out of high school. If you're able to list a particular set of endorsements, that would mean something to me as an employer, and certainly it should begin to mean something to higher education also. So I like the direction.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rose, do you have a bachelor's degree? Humor me for a moment, if you will.
Trick question, no.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, yes, ma'am, and the chair's not as comfortable as I thought it was.
And so do I. Okay. But I bet we didn't take the same subjects in college, and yet we both have bachelor's degrees, and the world seems to be able to interpret that. So my point with, and I truly do not want to make you feel uncomfortable about this, but my point is that we may be worrying about a consistency when we don't need to. People graduate with diplomas from high schools all over Oregon, and they don't take the same subjects. And yet we seem to know what a high school diploma is and assume that it has some intrinsic value that we are able to interpret. So I'm not as persuaded that we need to have exactly the same pieces in a SIM or whatever we call it in order for the world to find value in it.
Representative Farr?
Thank you. I see it as being a little bit different to a bachelor's degree, in that people out in the real world do know what a bachelor's degree is, but we have a problem with a SIM in that people don't really know what it is or how to define it. And I think the type of language that you are recommending helps us to do that while still remaining still allowing a great deal of flexibility for the individual student. So that's a real nice symmetry to the proposal.
And if I might, Mr. Chair.
Again, follow up. Yes, Representative Nolan.
One of the concerns I have is that I will acknowledge that we don't have a clear understanding and common language about what a certificate of initial mastery means, let alone a certificate of advanced mastery. And we risk exacerbating that by changing the definition every few years, because then it doesn't have a common language, it doesn't have a common meaning, because the SIMs that students are acquiring this year will not be the same as the SIMs that students acquire next year. So I raise concerns about that, and just acknowledge that I'm not persuaded personally that there is more danger in continuing to pursue, allow some discretion among districts than there is in continually
changing the rules.
Yes, I'm sure. Representative Farr.
A little back and forth. I understand exactly what Representative Nolan is saying, but we've done a tremendous amount of work on this as a committee and as a chair and as a department. I'm hoping, anticipating, and expecting that we won't be changing it anymore, that the work we've done to bring it to this point is the work that needed to be done. And so from now on, we will have a fixed package with the flexible endorsements, or however we decide to handle that. But you and I can talk.
Yeah.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with that. I'm concerned about us comparing it even to a diploma, in that that's one of the problems with a diploma, is a diploma is not a diploma is not a diploma. What we're saying with the SIM, and I think with all of the areas, but particularly the core areas, number one, they're in line with No Child Left Behind, and number two, that means that those students have met the state standards on that. It's real clear. They know how to do A, B, and C. And I guess when we entered this process, I was kind of hoping it would change, because as we moved into other areas, foreign language would become a part of it and health would become a part of it. I agree with you, Representative Nolan, that that could get very hard. I almost think this is a real good response to that, in that these endorsement areas can be added, and maybe 10 years down the road, we might want to look at changing it. This might alleviate us having to look at changing it in the real near future. I don't want to go through this again next session.
Yes.
An actual question for our witness, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You bet.
In the work session.
Mr. Rose, do you envision that by allowing endorsements, a school district could choose to offer an endorsement, for example, in geography and second language, but not in the arts or physical education? Or would you envision that the school district has to make all of those available to students, and it then becomes the student's choice as to whether to pursue individual endorsements?
Ms. Chairman, I'm Nolan. Do I get some points for how long I sat here and didn't interfere with the discussion? I actually got the question. We envision that the language says you may implement, and probably what they do in Ione in terms of may implement more would be different than what they do in Portland. But I'm a student at Ione, that's not a good example. I'm a student at SIL. And we're going to meet the high standards in math, English, and science and get a SIM. And I'm really interested in the arts. And SIL has some art, but they don't have enough program to get me to the level that I need to pass the state set standards. The value of this, by the way, from our point of view, is the state is going to set the standards in all these areas, so they, in fact, will be high and common. But then I, working with the SIL school district, and under the moves we're making with proficiency instead of seat time, that movement, we're going to be able to start constructing where else in the community can I get what I need as part of my program to meet the standards to get an endorsement in art on my SIM. Mm-hmm. And it's more valuable to me than my diploma. Again, a diploma is a series of courses with a variety of grades. I got a diploma because I had all A's in my courses, and I imagine you had all C's. So our diplomas are not similar, okay? If you put the whole package together, what we're trying to create for kids, and you ought not forget where they're headed with the proficiency issue, it's that I can start thinking about how do I get this done, and the district, contrary to what some would suggest, districts are really probably interested in helping their kids get where they want to go on an individual basis, rather than packaging all the kids have to take art, all the kids have to do this. And over time, that's the way we'll start thinking about curriculum, and kids will drive with it. You also know that part of this at the school level is an individual education plan. It's not an IEP, it's an education profile each kid's going to develop. And so the district may, when I walk into the school, it may not offer it. But now what do we have to do to help me get it? And we may go to Cascade. I mean, SIO, I may do something at Cascade. I may do something with some private art things that are available somewhere in the middle of Marion County. And that's the way I envision that it would unfold. Opportunities will be greater in larger centers. That's the way life is, but that's the way it's been forever. When I went to high school, I could take a Latin or I could take nothing. Other schools offered two or three languages, so you'll never get over that hurdle, right, as long as we're spread out. But this creates an incentive with a reward at the end and a label that will be valuable to the student, given the student's interest.
I think a couple things. Ozzie, you mentioned, of course, I know you're being facetious, that you got all A's because you didn't take Latin. And I think we're all aware that Representative Nolan probably didn't get all C's, in as much she is a Dartmouth graduate. So I suspect that she did a bit better than the C's.
Summa cum laude.
Oh, all right.
I'm out of my league, I apologize.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ozzie. Bob. Yeah.
Chairman, Bob Wilner, Oregon International Council, Federation of Oregon Language Teaching. In this last great act of defiance, when I was facing Alan, in the middle of the Battle of Baghdad, I don't see how we can claim to be offering world-class education if we don't require history, geography, civics, academics, and foreign language on our students. And to say that you know the certificate of initial mastery, but you don't have any foreign language, but you don't know anything about history, it's just hard for me to see how that can be real.
Except, Bob, if I can jump in here. Our bill does nothing to change current high school graduation requirements or current high school curriculum requirements. So students would have to take U.S. history, for example, a certain number of English classes, and have to take a year of health. That's typically done in two different semesters in different years of school, and so on. So we certainly don't want to minimize the importance of these other subjects. But I don't know that the fact that they're not SIM subjects would necessarily change anything from where we have been or where we are.
I guess that is my concern. The reason for the SIM was that there would be this defined learning expectation for you. And insofar as we back away from that statement of expectations and thinking deep in the whole process, I just wonder if we go through this process of further amending the stance this time around, do we really think there won't be another campaign 2 years from now to weaken it further? I confess to a very grave sense of irony that the previous discussion was on how to strengthen expectations in a different sense while we were basically weakening them in this sense. We set out some very brave standard expectations 2 years back, and we've been chipping away at them ever since. And I can't escape the feeling that the current economic pressures are, yes, they are heavy and hard to bear, but I cannot avoid the suspicion that they are welcomed by some as an excuse for getting rid of what they've been wanting to get rid of for the last 10, 12 years. I cannot escape the sense that when we talk about No Child Left Behind, and we don't have the resources to do all this, we are forgetting that it is not just the schools that are responsible for what a child learns, but the child has to take some responsibility, the community has to take some responsibility, the parents have to take some responsibility. I haven't seen that endorsed or any reminder of that. If I could pass on a recollection from a friend of mine I met when I first came to Oregon, Lynn Winter, raised in Holland in World War II, he said, as the Allied air raids on Germany started, air raid sirens went off every night so the kids stopped doing their homework. Finally, the school said, this is ridiculous. We'll have an uneducated population. They put out a notice saying, any kid whose house is actually hit by a bomb is excused from doing his homework, otherwise he had it done. And they did it. And they got a first-class education. I keep feeling, if we made it clear that this is what you kids are expected to do, and, you know, your teacher is not going to be perfect, nothing's going to be perfect, but you have to do the best you can with what you got. You get a lot more done. There'd be a lot more learning. And I'm afraid that I just get the feeling that there's a concerted, the coalition of the unwilling is winning. The people who in 1992 said, don't worry, it'll all go away. They're smirking. And that this bill is not very smart. I guess it's impossible to expect that we just leave the bill the way it is. But if there's going to be a change, I hope it at least maintains that these options, that every school must offer these options. All this May stuff. What if a kid wants to get a CIM in foreign language and they don't offer it? What if he wants to get a CIM in social sciences and, well, they don't have that much economics? It just strikes me as taking too many easy ways out. And I would hope this committee can go over this one more time and just make sure. Can we really set some clear expectations for kids learn here? And a clear statement that the kids have some responsibility and the parents have some my thing for years has been foreign language, and I think that's essential. I don't see how we can claim it's a world-class education if they don't at least, if the school has the option of not even offering the foreign language. I guess anything else I'll say will be a repetition of what I said 1779 before. Thank you for hearing me. Mm-hmm. I hope that we can keep the pressure on one way or another. And I'll say again, there is a war going on out there, and I hate to think of another generation of kids growing up without even knowing where these places are, not let alone what we can be involved in. That's basically what I have to say. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Yeah. Well, stimulating afternoon and hearing roomy. Yes, we'll bring this bring back 2744 on Wednesday, and we've got some food for thought that had been added to the porridge, let us say. So with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2744, and we'll adjourn the meeting. Great.